This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. The Electoral College is a holdover from the very first United States government. What is its role now in the U.S. election? Is it democratic or anti-democratic? And should it be reformed? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Last week's U.S. presidential election once again revealed fractures in the democratic principles of one person, one vote, and the practice of the Electoral College. President-elect Joe Biden has consistently led in the counting of the popular vote in this election, at this point, over 5 million more votes than President Donald Trump. But the Electoral College renders the popular vote moot. Instead, winning state elections is the key to winning the presidential election. On today's show, we examine the Electoral College and the constitutional motivations behind the Electoral College and explore whether this creates a democracy deficit in the conduction of American elections. Our guests are Sanford Levinson, the W. St. John Garwood Jr. Centennial Chair in Law at the University of Texas. He's the author of numerous books, including Fault Lines in the Constitution with Cynthia Levinson, which just recently came out in graphic novel form. And Jeremy Suri, professor in the Department of History and the LBJ School of Public Affairs. He holds the Mac Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership in Global Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. He is the author of The Impossible Presidency, The Rise and Fall of America's Highest Office. So, Professor Levinson, we'll start with you. You've written this book, Fault Lines in the Constitution. How much is the Electoral College one of those fault lines in the Constitution?
Oh, sure. I think that it takes up more pages than any other of the 20 fault lines that my wife and I identify. And I should say for a moment that the whole idea of fault lines, it's a metaphor obviously adopted from geology, the tectonic plates underneath the ground that one generally ignores until they actually come together and can wreak havoc. So our book is largely about structures. It's not particularly about rights. My own view is that we spend way too much time talking about the Constitution as a document of rights and way too little time talking about structural aspects of the Constitution. And that, as with the St. Andreas Fault, most of the time you can live your lives and simply ignore them and hope they'll go away. The Electoral College, for much of the time, is like that. It's just an oddball detail of the way we do things. But every now and then, and every now and then is becoming much more frequent, it really does turn out to be a menace to the American Republic. And this year is kind of one of those years, not so vivid as 2000 or 2016, or in a somewhat different way, 1968 and 1992, where the winners, that is Richard Nixon and Bill Clinton, each got to the White House with 43% of the vote. And one can make a very, very real argument that there is something wrong with a system of selecting presidents that puts in the White House somebody who is that far short of demonstrable majority support.
And Jeremy Suri, the Electoral College certainly has distortions in the democratic process in presidential elections. Is this a democracy deficit, the fact that the U.S. still uses the Electoral College?
Absolutely. And I think we could argue it's been a democracy deficit from inception. It was created in part to limit the democratic nature of our presidential elections. That's one of the original sins in our society, and it's connected, of course, to slavery. And so this process over time has led to, I think, as Sandy pointed out already, a growing separation in certain periods, including our own, between the way the popular will is registered in presidential elections and the ways in which the regional will is manifest in these elections. And it's quite striking now, aside from simply the outcomes we've seen, that you can have a state like California, for example, which gets almost no attention in presidential campaigning any longer because the Republicans realize they have no chance of winning the state, and they don't care if they lose the state by 10 million votes or by 6 million votes or by 4 million votes. So it essentially disenfranchises those voters from having influence upon the selection of a presidential candidate, whereas many of us, for a few nights in a row, we were sitting on the edge of our seats waiting for some almost unpopulated counties in Nevada to come in and for their votes. And those votes turn out to be incredibly decisive in an election like this. So it's a distortion that places territory above people. And that's a problem for a democracy.
Sandy, one of the arguments in favor of the Electoral College is it does require campaigns to pay attention to every state. That there wasn't an Electoral College, the largest states would be all the campaigns would care about. How accurate is that?
It's demonstrably false. It's a silly argument for reasons that Jeremy spelled out. Take Texas. Kamala Harris visited Texas in the last week of the campaign because the Biden campaign at that point fell under what turned out to be the delusional belief that Texas, for the first time in decades, might be in play for a Democratic candidate. But my wife and I spend our time usually, except for this semester, between Austin and Boston. In Massachusetts, one knows that there's a presidential campaign going on because the Massachusetts television market includes New Hampshire. In Texas, you would really never know there's a presidential campaign going on. So there is this truly anti-democratic, indefensible ignorance of many of the largest states of the country, New York, Illinois, Texas, and California, which almost never get campaign visits because if you're a political junkie, you really can predict how they're going to go. But it's also simply demonstrably untrue that the candidates are going to show up in most of the small states, because if they're predictable, they don't go to Idaho, they don't go to the Dakotas. Now, in fact, they might show up in New Hampshire, because New Hampshire had become something of a swing state. If Al Gore had campaigned in New Hampshire instead of Florida the last week in 2000, he would have been president. Democrats have a fixation on Florida that is difficult to justify because it's demonstrably true that Democrats don't need to carry Florida in order to win a national race. That being said, Hillary Clinton visited Florida 25 times and never bothered to return to Wisconsin after the primary there. So the Electoral College, in every conceivable way, distorts the campaign, and no reasonable person can argue that the Electoral College assures that candidates will pay attention to more than literally about 9 to 12 states. And you can measure this in terms of their allocation of spending for advertisements, on where they actually show up, where the surrogates go. So I think the argument is simply irrational.
Now, we focused so far on geographic distortions, how often they visit states, et cetera. But I also think the way issues get framed certainly are driven by the Electoral College. One that immediately comes to mind was the importance of the issue of fracking, specifically because of its location in Pennsylvania, where everybody assumed was going to determine this election, despite the fact that there's actually not all that much fracking going on. And also, Americans are much more opposed to fracking than the handful of swing voters in Pennsylvania that might determine that. So first, Jeremy Seri, I don't know if you agree with me on that issue, and are there other issues that sort of come to mind that show that the issues that drive the election really are being driven by the Electoral College as opposed to broadly issues that reflect the general population?
Pennsylvania. Race is the overwhelming example of this. This election didn't turn on Georgia. It's a big win for Joe Biden in Georgia, but it turned on Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. These are states that have overwhelmingly white male voting populations and white female voting populations as well. But what's interesting about the white male voters is the white male voters tend to be the voters who are most resistant to a discussion of race in the election. And because they are the ones that in some ways the candidates are fighting over, you end up with a very distorted discussion of race in our election. So we had all this, I think, legitimate and important discussion about criminal justice reform during the Democratic primaries, even some of it among Republicans. There are a lot of libertarian Republicans who have concerns about the way our criminal justice system works. But all of that falls out of the presidential race because of the voters in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. If the swing states turned out to be places like Georgia and Mississippi, then you'd see a very different discussion going on, or California for that matter. So issue after issue, it's not only that the candidates trim their opinions, it's that we then get candidates who are not representative of where the public really is on these issues. The Democratic Party was smart to choose someone like Joe Biden who could demonstrably win in these swing states. But he actually was out of the mainstream in many ways of where the Democratic Party was on many of these issues. And if you had a truly national election, the Democratic Party could perhaps win on criminal justice reform, on environmental issues, in a way it can't in this system.
One of the pieces of conventional wisdom is that vice presidential candidates really don't matter. Or I think the slightly tweaked way of putting it is that vice presidential candidates historically might explain 2% of the vote, but most people really don't care. I wonder this particular year if Georgia went Democratic because of Kamala Harris, and if Pennsylvania and Michigan went Democratic because of the turnout in the big, big cities, African-American turnout. I mean, Wisconsin is very different, except for Milwaukee.
And Madison.
But I don't think there's a very high percentage of African-Americans in Madison. It's like Austin, which right. In fact is basically an Anglo and Mexican-American city
right. Rather
than one with a very high percentage of African-Americans. But I can imagine that the numbers crunchers might end up saying that it was Kamala Harris who won the election for Biden, and that in essence, she didn't have to make the issue of racial justice front and center other than by showing up. But as I say, to some extent, this is an empirical question. I think there's no doubt that the black vote was absolutely crucial, and that more African-American voters came out this year than in 2016, where, quite frankly, they didn't see much in Hillary and Tim Kaine that should mobilize them.
Right. The complexity, of course, Sandy, is how many voters did her presence on the ticket alienate? And one could make the argument that her presence on the ticket might have actually helped generate more Republican turnout in a state like Texas, for example.
Good. I mean, this is why I'd really love to see what some of the professionals come up with when they crunch the numbers.
Right.
Now, Sandy, since we've identified how the Electoral College can distort the elections, sort of the last big topic I want to address then is, you know, what do we do about this? Because I know there was an attempt to eliminate the Electoral College back in the late 70s, and it was defeated by yet another issue that we could certainly talk about with respect to democracy deficit, the filibuster. There's a campaign for states, a sufficient number of Electoral College votes
right. From
states that will simply designate their votes to whoever wins the popular vote. Is this the best way to approach this? Would some form of a constitutional amendment be the best way to approach this, or is this just something we're stuck with?
Well, it's a very, very good question. My friend Alex Kazar at the JFK School at Harvard published a really terrific, very scholarly book with the title, Why Do We Still Have the Electoral College? And the answer is relatively complex, and I'll try to go through it quickly, because one aspect is that the Electoral College, most people think of simply in terms that there's the possible disjunction between the popular vote and the electoral vote, which is certainly true. But the Electoral College system also includes, as a matter of practice, the winner-take-all feature of allocating the votes for every state except Maine and Nebraska. It also includes the feature that actual turnout doesn't matter so long as your side wins. So it has a vote-suppressing aspect to it. And the fourth part of the Electoral College system is the so-called contingent election system, whereby if the Electoral College doesn't agree on a majority, or if, as in 1800, there is a tie, the House of Representatives picks on a one-state, one-vote basis. Since 1816, the Electoral College has been under systematic attack. And James Madison, by the 1820s, agreed that the Electoral College was a really bad idea, in part because of the contingent election system, which we saw in all of its glory in 1824, when John Quincy Adams got to the White House, even though he had gotten fewer popular votes and fewer electoral votes than Andrew Jackson. So there was a lot of talk beginning then with getting rid of this thing. So why haven't we? Say, one answer is that it's not merely saying we want a popular vote, and like, because there are all of these nested problems that big states, big battleground states, tend to like the Electoral College because they get all this unjustified attention. The ruling elites in California are delighted with the Electoral College because it means 55 sure votes for the Democrats. And why should they care if 40% of the Republicans are simply disenfranchised, in effect? In Texas, it's the same logic. And then you have, you know, the other features. But what it boils down to, according to Alex, is Article 5, that it is immensely difficult to amend the Constitution. It was actually 1969, not the 70s, is when you got a proposed amendment through the House, that is two-thirds of the House, in a cross-party coalition, said, we got to get rid of it. Richard Nixon agreed that the Electoral College was a bad idea. It failed in the Senate because of a filibuster led by two white racist supremacists, Sam Ervin, whose historical memory is that of the kindly, justice-oriented senator at the time of Watergate. But however courtly Ervin was, he was in fact a white supremacist, and he always voted against every civil rights bill, and reform of the Electoral College was viewed as the equivalent of a civil rights bill because it would break the stranglehold that white supremacists had basically over the Democratic Party. But with Strom Thurmond and the Southern strategy, they could see it happening for the Republican Party. That was the last time there was a truly serious attempt. And my own view of Article 5 is that it's probably the single worst feature of what I regard as a very defective, you mentioned fault lines, Article 5 is itself a fault line. But then there's the second thing you brought up. What about the end run around Article 5 by the so-called Fair Vote Initiative? So California, Pennsylvania, Texas, Florida, all agree to give their votes to the person who comes in first. That's a wonderful solution if you are fixated on 2000 and 2016. If, on the other hand, you are bothered by 1968 and 1992, then the fair vote proposal does literally nothing to solve that problem. First of all, if I could wave a magic wand, I would get rid of the presidential system. I would ask Jeremy to get a new specialty, because I think that Max Weber was correct about 100 years ago when he suggested that presidentialism in the modern era, when you couple it with mass parties and mass media of a kind that Weber could never have imagined, that feeds Caesarism. And I think that is a real problem with the American presidency. But assuming we're stuck with a presidential system, then I would at least like the president to be able to make a more or less demonstrable claim that he or she was supported by the majority of the electorate. And the fair vote proposal really doesn't speak to that. There is a tweak on it that said, well, you could get there only if you got 45% of the vote. I don't think 45% is good enough. I want majority vote. I want a runoff, as in the state of Georgia, as in France, as in a number of other systems where you can't get to the office unless you demonstrate majority support.
It's interesting what Sandy says. I agree with it, but we do have to recognize that means Abraham Lincoln probably never would have been elected president.
Oh, yes. And Abraham Lincoln's election triggered Civil War. And if you want to get rid of the Electoral College, then Lincoln might not have become president. Well, yes, that's true.
Yeah. The only thing I'd add to what Sandy said, which I think is incredibly powerful and compelling, and I agree with a lot of it, and I think much of it is built into the problems of a presidential system. And it's important for listeners to recognize that our presidential system, even though we claim it's a model for the world, it's very strange compared to any other system in the world. Until really the 1950s, one thing that leavened the problems of the Electoral College is it was at least a dynamic system. We had new states coming into the system, so it wasn't as static as it's become. One of the problems we face with the Electoral College, with our Supreme Court, with so many elements of our system, is that we've been stuck now for about half a century in a position where we're unwilling to make any change at all. And we're unwilling to make any change because we're unsatisfied with what we have, but there's no consensus on what to do about it. And I think this is the most profound Article 5 problem we have, that because it's so difficult to make these changes, right? It's not that there's a consensus to do what we're doing now. There really isn't. It's that it's very hard to form that consensus to change this. And that's how I explain, and I think this is what Alex Kasar is arguing too, that's why I explain the permanence of the Electoral College. No one likes it. It's very hard to justify in any sense, but it's very hard to organize a political coalition of sufficient number to do anything about it. That's the problem. It's a political problem. It's not an analytical problem.
Thank you both very much. We've spoken about the Electoral College and its impact on American democracy with Sanford Levinson, the W. St. John Garwood and W. St. John Garwood Jr. Centennial Chair in Law at the University of Texas, and Jeremy Suri, Professor in the Department of History and the LBJ School of Public Affairs. He holds the Mack Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership in Global Affairs at the University of Texas. That's correct. Both of our guests join us from Austin, and I thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you to our guests and to you for listening. The Scholar Circle team includes Doug Becker and Lillian Ng, contributing hosts, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers, Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Tim Page and Mike Hurst, engineers and technical support. I'm Maria Armudian, and we'll see you next week.